And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and Max Verstappen won again in Monaco, but he had to work hard for it, given the threat posed by Fernando Alonso. But was there a way for Aston Martin to have won this race? And what does Sergio Perez's disastrous weekend mean for the World Championship battle? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to answer those questions and more are Scott Mitchell-Maun and Mark Hughes.
Well, Mark, I'll say hello to you, because I've said hello to you several times this weekend. We're in an echoey room at the moment, so how's Monaco been for you?
Yeah, it's been great. Apart from all the sitting next to you for hours on end, but yeah, it's been good.
I don't like sitting next to myself for hours on end at the best of times, so bad to impose it on other people. I've had a very nice weekend, apart from the very angry and unhelpful Monaco police directing traffic and just making you do laps of going out of Monaco and then eventually letting you go where you can
go. I think they were rivaled by the Monegasque caterers just this evening, who didn't want us to queue.
Well, you were leading a mob, weren't you?
I was, yeah. I wasn't having it.
There's a good moment where Mark was told just to wait, and he was just standing there, and he just said, well, I'm waiting. It was very odd and angry, but there we go. But those are just very minor quibbles. Monaco Grand Prix is always a great weekend. How's it been for you, how's it been for you, Scott? Your name's Scott, not Monaco.
That's an interesting one. It's been interesting watching it. I'm not on site. I think it's obviously nobody made it to Imola. Well, I made it to Imola. I just had to turn around and come back home a few hours later. This is my first event of the season that I've worked remotely, not been on site for. I have to admit, it gave me a good opportunity to appreciate the smattering of new camera angles and efforts that went into the slightly new look Monaco TV coverage, now that F1 is sharing that with the locals instead of it being an independent production as it has been for so long. So that was really cool. I have to admit, getting a bit of a break from the nonsense that the two of you were describing just now is one of the reasons why I didn't really fancy going to Monaco. I was happy to miss it this year. But I have to say, watching it from afar again, I think this weekend was a great example of what it should be on the calendar, as well as the things about it that still need to be improved and the things that don't quite work for modern F1. But, you know, I don't think there's as tense a place for qualifying as there is Monaco. That was fantastic. Following that from afar, and even the Grand Prix, like as long as you've got evenly matched cars on slightly different strategies, that is capable of producing fascinating racing, and there's always the potential for a little bit of a rain shower to spice things up. So I enjoyed it following it from here.
Yeah, it's such a phenomenal track, such a challenge. And there's a great reminder of that, not just from watching the cars this weekend, but one evening, because obviously the circuit's open at night, I had to drive around a bit of it to get to where I was going. And you just sort of sit there in your Fiat Tipo hire car thinking, yeah, barreling along here at some amazing speed just takes tremendous precision. So it's a great feat of driving here from pretty much everyone. So let's get into it, Scott. Given the rain that started to get serious after about 50 laps, Max Verstappen was leading, Fernando Alonso was second. But was it a surprise to see Aston Martin fit slicks rather than intermediates? And is there any way you think that Aston Martin could have played this better to perhaps even nab a win?
Well, it was a surprise to me, because I know everybody has their own kind of views in these situations. I can only view it from the small amount of experience I have covering Formula One, and just the slightly irrelevant but only reference I've got of amateur racing, which is that when you get changeable conditions, I think that kind of changeable condition, once it reaches a certain point, I'd like to get off the slick tire as soon as possible. So it just that felt like the no-brainer move for me. So I was surprised to see that they went for the slicks. It was so close, if not past the point of a crossover. I felt like Alonso was completely safe in second, to the point of could probably undo that change to intermediates if he needed to, but I felt the chances of that were really, really slim, because I felt that everyone would be going on to intermediates. And it was just a great chance to base essentially box opposite to Verstappen, who was obviously had already carried on for at least one more lap. So I was surprised to see them put slicks on. It's been explained away relatively well. The logic makes a lot more sense when you realise two factors. One, Aston noticed that the temperature in Alonso's tyres, the old hards that he'd been using up until that point, were dropping and were therefore a performance and, I guess, safety risk as much as anything else, could have slid off the road. But the second factor is the most important one, which is that they didn't think it would rain that much or for that long. So they kind of thought, okay, we can ride this out with a better tyre than what we were on just now, and he was keeping it on the road. And then so there'll be a few laps of management, but then we'll be able to really get stuck into it. And this will be the tyre we take to the end of the Grand Prix. But it took about 30 seconds for them to realise, once he came out of the pits, that was the wrong decision. Had he gone on to intermediates, would he have won the race? Potentially. I'm not as convinced as I was initially. There's a good argument to be made that Alonso would have taken seriously close to the full gap that Verstappen had in just one lap on inters versus Verstappen's in lap on the slicks. But it's not a like-for-like comparison, because Verstappen's in lap, which is the only reference we've got for it, was much more cautious, because they knew that Alonso was out on slick still and have to be coming in for inters anyway. So there was no rush for Verstappen to get back. I feel my gut feeling is that he probably would have rejoined marginally ahead of Alonso, and therefore we'd still have had the same result, but I think it would have potentially been closer, and he would have had the opportunity, because the pressure would then have been on Verstappen to get back to the pits as quickly as possible on the slicks. So I think the better chance to win was to go on to the intermediates, but they had their reasons for not doing that.
Mark, you've been speaking to Red Bull and crunching the numbers. Do you think there was any chance with a one lap undercut on intermediates he could have jumped him?
I think it's unlikely, for the reason Scott's just talked about, but I do get the logic in terms of Aston. Every choice Aston's made this weekend has been a very aggressive one, from the way it attacked qualifying to its tyre choice for the race. It's almost like they weren't interested in being a safe second. They felt that they could do that relatively easily. They felt this is their one, maybe their best chance of the season to nick a victory, and that to get onto the slicks and hope that the rain stopped quickly enough that they saved a whole pit stop of Verstappen was a theoretical route to that victory. And so they went for it because they had a big enough gap over third place that, as Scott said, they could, if it didn't work, they could just come back in and correct that without losing position, which is, in fact, exactly what they did. So, no, I completely get it, even though the conditions, if you just looked at the conditions and the situation without the perspective of the season and Aston's ambitions, you would say, no, the logical thing to do is to go on in. It's raining quite heavily, and the risk of going off if you go on slicks is quite high. So no, the logical racing thing to do would be to just get straight on to inters. But they were in a very feisty, aggressive frame of mind coming into this weekend, because it was, as I say, a real chance to snatch a win off the dominant Red Bull team.
I must admit, I was quite surprised when I spoke to Mike Crack, the Aston Martin team principal, after the race in the pit lane, when they said that the medium seemed to be the logical move for the conditions, but it certainly did give them a shot at a win if the weather had gone a different way anyway. So yeah, a really good weekend for Aston Martin. You know, we're saying, well, did Aston Martin miss a chance to win? They finished second, they keep being on the podium. This amazing season keeps going on for them. And if they keep doing this, there will be a day when they get a win. Let's move on now to, this is normally the how the race was won section, but I'm going to call it the how pole was won, because that was what basically gave Verstappen the position. Now, obviously, it was a thrilling pole position battle with Alonso on provisional pole and then Verstappen pipping him just at the end. So how did he do that, particularly that last sector reversal?
Yeah, that was the key. That's where he really, really had to pull it out of the bag and did a fantastic job in doing so. But the reason why he had to pull it out of the bag, why he was almost 3/10 down after two sectors, is all to do with the traits of the Red Bull, which we've talked about many times this season before, and how it treats its tyres. And we've seen on the race, the more conventional tracks up to this time, that the Red Bull's qualifying advantage is relatively small and its race advantage big. That remains so, but was even more the case around Monaco, because the circuit is very gentle on the tyres. So, and because the Red Bull is conceived the way it is, it doesn't put heat very quickly into the front tyres. So that's always a tricky thing, especially with the traits of the C5 Pirellis this weekend, because it meant that they were effectively a one-lap qualifying tyre. You couldn't do multiple lap runs on them. So you had to do basically a... The best way of doing it was to do a pretty hard out lap, and the best way of doing it for every other car apart from the Red Bull was to do a pretty hard out lap and get straight into it. But the Red Bull wouldn't bring the tyres up to full temperature doing that, so it required an extra preparation lap, an out lap plus a preparation lap, which meant that it had gone past the peak grip by the time it actually started its flying lap. And that was just, there was no getting around that. And so the way they had to do the lap was knowing that they would be significantly down on Alonso after the first two sectors. It was quite plain all weekend. But what was also plain all weekend was that the Aston was very poor in the final sector. Therefore, it was perfectly feasible, but very much a stretch, for Verstappen to nick all that time back off them in the final sector, because they were weak there. And all he had to do really was do the tyre prep lap perfectly, do a good solid sector one and sector two, which he did, and then do that almighty banzai sector three. And he did that to perfection. It was a very tricky pole position to access. It was in the car, but it wasn't easy to get. That was very, very difficult, and they did it perfectly.
Yeah, to underscore that, I think it's very easy to say, oh, Max Verstappen, Red Bull, easy. I think that most drivers would not have been on pole in that scenario. That was really, really outstanding for Verstappen. And to put it into context, 19 seconds for that last sector, he found about 0.16 from his first run in Q3 time. So that's a pretty big percentage gain to be found. And I think probably Alonso was a little bit surprised by just how much Verstappen pulled back. He maybe regrets not laying it on the line a tiny bit more at the end of the lap. But as you say, it was still tricky for Aston Martin, because there were various compromises there. But that was absolutely key, and that was what gave Verstappen the lead of the race early on. And then he was able to be a reasonable amount up the road when he got to that scenario we were talking about with the rain coming. Now, Scott, with Max Verstappen winning, we've got to ask about title rival Sergio Perez. Obviously, he won here last year. He'll have been hoping for something big. He is the man for street circuits, apparently. Instead, he ended up finishing 16th. So what did you make of his weekend?
Avoidably and very damagingly poor, I think. You could tell the magnitude of the qualifying crash was clearly not lost on him. I can't remember the last time we heard a front runner talk in those terms, with the way that Perez was sort of saying, like, you know, I can't believe what I've just done. And then obviously we had a little bit more of the slightly more usual, you know, I've let the team down, I'm going to have an impossible race. But you could tell he obviously knew the significance of it. So the damage was done in qualifying. It was going to take a near miracle to achieve anything of note in the Grand Prix. Even getting into the points was always going to be a tall order. I remember in the past when Verstappen crashed here in I think it was 18, wasn't it, in practice, missed qualifying, started at the back. I think he barely got into the points. It was a real, real struggle to get inside the top 10. Even when you got the best car, that's just how it is. And the race was playing out in a very frustrating way for him. And then, yeah, just when you think the weekend couldn't get any worse, it did. It didn't just go from bad to worse. I think it went from worse to absolutely terrible.
Yeah, and Perez was very down on himself both after the race and after qualifying. You could tell he was just kicking himself for what happened there. And Mark, as always, we've got questions in the Race Members Club. They'll come up at the end of the podcast, but we'd like to drop in a few earlier if they're relevant to something we're talking about. So this is the right time to address this from Mike Meredith, who asks, does this signal the end for Perez's title challenge? He was on the back foot because of his grid position, but this was not a champion's drive, was it? 39 points now, the gap.
Yeah, it's put a severe dent in it, and this was, he's had a real, considering the his strengths as a driver, the first six races have been a really nice sequence of tracks for him to really capitalize on his strengths. And this, of course, he's had some great races here in the past and won a year last year, of course. So this should have been one of the ones where he was able to take the fight to Max, just as he'd been doing. You know, he did it in Baku, he did it in a slightly different way, but in Miami also, Jeddah. So, yeah, we're now off to more conventional tracks where you would expect Max to begin stretching his legs. So this was a really, really important one, I think, for Perez to nail, not necessarily win, but at least to score some heavy points to fight Max for. And it was incomprehensible, the error he made. It's Q1, he's in a Red Bull, and why on earth would you be putting it on the edge, you know, through Sandevort in Q1 when you're in a Red Bull? It's just absolutely incomprehensible.
My interpretation of that crash in qualifying, which I wrote about after it happened, was that it was kind of indicative of the difference between Verstappen and Perez, in that this was the place, I mentioned it earlier, Verstappen learned a hard lesson, didn't he, a few years ago, that you really need to pace yourself in a place like Monaco. You don't need to show everything in every single session. But a driver like Verstappen, with the ability that he has and the pace that he has, he does have that luxury of just picking his moments to really unleash everything. And I just got the impression, with the fact that Perez was quite close in FP3 and then quite close on the first runs in Q3, I just felt like Perez was really, really having to take it to the limit to live with Verstappen. And as Mark was explaining there, there's a lot on the line this weekend, another good opportunity for him. And I think that's what I think he had to be at 100% the whole way through to have any chance of arriving at Q3 in a place to beat Verstappen. But just to, I think Sunday, just to add, you know, rub salt into the wound, it was almost like, I think he described it as the worst weekend he could remember. But it was that thing of like everything that could have gone wrong in his control and out of it did. It wasn't just, you know, he was slow or he made a mistake. He said everything obviously went back to that singular error in qualifying. He knows that, he can't make any excuses beyond that. But then you've got the tripping over of, was it Magnussen's Haas in the race that he ended up, he broke his front wing on and damaged that. So it's another setback, having already spent so long frustrated behind another car. And then I thought he was absolutely blameless and luckless with that Russell rejoin at Mirabeau. That was just insult to injury, wasn't it? Just to have a clash like that. So you couldn't, I don't think from Q1 onwards, you could not have scripted a worst possible weekend for a supposed title challenger. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, and I must admit, really, you needed the points to be reversed almost. You needed Perez to be 39 points ahead. And then we'd be saying, well, is that enough of a cushion going into a bunch of races that should suit Verstappen? It's just the problem. When you're up against someone like Max Verstappen, you can't afford mistakes, and dropping it twice in Q1 in six races is going to really, really hurt you. And Perez knew that. He was the first to point that out after the race. You could still tell after the race that yesterday's mistake was really on his mind. It was really playing on it. The Magnussen one was a bit stupid, but you know, it was the Saturday one that he seemed to be struggling to reconcile himself with.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Let's move on to the other podium finisher, Scott Alpine. Finally had something to be happy about. Esteban Ocon, third place. How impressed were you with his performance?
Yeah, I'm very impressed with Ocon this weekend. Just one of those weekends in which we've seen it a few times from different drivers in Monaco, where a driver in one of the more upper midfield teams has a good feeling, the car's competitive, and they grow in confidence. And Ocon was almost like the poster boy for that track evolution and the unpredictability of qualifying, and especially Q3. Because obviously Alonso being in the mix, we all kind of thought that might happen, and the Ferraris as well. And then when Ocon was suddenly up there, it's just like, well, you can't predict anything from this. So the pure one lap pace was very impressive. And there was that phase when he was running in the top three, having obviously benefited from Leclerc's grid penalty, where, okay, there's been one or two things that have boosted him into that position, that grid penalty, Perez's crash. But Ocon wasn't in that top three place by luck. He was there because of his raw speed on Saturday, and the fact that he kept it all four wheels pointing the right way and out of the barriers. So couldn't begrudge him the fact that he was the person in a position to inherit third from Leclerc. And then he did obviously a faultless job in the dry, which is, I guess it's kind of straightforward in an F1 in Monaco context, but F1 in Monaco is never that easy. So that in itself, keeping the train of faster cars behind him, not getting too carried away, not making any mistakes, not overworking his tyres, that was just a very measured, mature, controlled part of the Grand Prix. But I was really, really impressed with how he dealt with the changing conditions, the rainfall, then that stint at the end on Inters with Hamilton close behind. Again, if you don't make any mistakes in Monaco, you will hold that position. But that just makes it sound so much easier than it is. And I'm really, really impressed with how he's so composed and robust in those situations. I don't see Ocon as a particularly stunning defensive driver or anything like that necessarily. But one thing I think he's really, really good at is when he finds himself in those positions where it's completely on him and basically, the result is his if he doesn't make a mistake because overtaking is difficult or whatever. He's really, really, really robust. I don't think he makes silly mistakes in those situations. I'm thinking of his first win, of his win in Hungary, obviously, in 21. The drive in front of Hamilton again in Japan last year in those horrible wet conditions. And I think this was another example of it. So a display of one of Ocon's best strengths, I think, and a really fitting, deserved way to end a very, very good weekend.
And Pierre Gasly backed him up in seventh place. Gasly actually was a bit frustrated because he was asking to be left out in case the rain came. And he felt if he'd not been called in for a couple of laps, he could have backed that up with a fourth place as well by not having to make two pit stops to go to a new set of slicks and then to the intermediates. But slightly trickier weekend for Gasly, struggling with a bit of rear locking, he said, in qualifying, didn't quite get it together. But yeah, a solid one for Alpine. Mark, another question from the Race Members Club that's very pertinent here. This one's from Oscar Robledo, who asks, is the Alpine a Monaco-specific car, or have they turned a corner?
That's a very good question, and I think even Alpine isn't quite sure yet. But it came here with quite a good-looking upgrade on the side pods, and it's got new rear suspension. So there's reason to be optimistic that this is a genuine improvement in pace. The Alpine's been a bit inconsistent, but even before this upgrade, there have been little glimpses of form. It's sort of snapping at the heels of the Mercedes, Ferrari, at the tail end of that little group there, from time to time, and maybe now it can get in among it. That would be great to see if it could do that. We'll get a proper read on that in Barcelona, a more demanding track.
Yeah, and I asked Alan Permain, the sporting director, about that inconsistency in the car and whether they've understood it. He did slightly push back on the impression of inconsistency because he felt they had reasonably consistent performance out of the car, but perhaps there's just a certain degree of execution, I don't know, that was making it difficult. But this is what Alpine needs to be doing. Obviously, there was some good fortune in terms of finishing third rather than, say, sixth or whatever. But even just little things like that strategy in qualifying, running him a little bit offset because he was on provisional pole with a couple of minutes to go. And they were probably rubbing their hands because a red flag or a yellow seemed inevitable, quite frankly. Of course, it didn't come. So clever little move from there. Lovely lap from Ocon as well. We were admiring his lap this morning, weren't we?
It was beautifully economical. And he's got lovely feel with getting the rotation and the car and the brakes into the chicane. And yeah, it's one slight little error at the hairpin, but you'd be quibbling to talk about that, really. It was a lovely lap. And he really has got a lovely way with the car when he's on form.
Yeah, and a great weekend for him. Scott, there was a bit of hope pre-weekend that Ferrari could be a threat for victory at Monaco. Really didn't come to pass. Charles Leclerc sixth, Carlos Sainz eighth. Bit of dissent over the radio along the way as well. So did Ferrari underachieve? And what did you make of the way they went about the race?
Yeah, I think Sainz has kind of accepted that he was probably a little bit too harsh over the radio, but he still wants to have a proper review because his issue is basically that strategy and why when they were both on the hard tyres, why he wasn't given the option to try and extend as long as possible, because he felt that not only did he have the pace to ward off the threat of the undercut from Hamilton, which is what Ferrari was singularly focused on, and that's why they brought him in relatively early for someone on the hards. He obviously realises in hindsight he probably would have been able to manage those tyres up until the crossover for Inters and got a really good result out of it. You'll be surprised to hear that strategically, I'm not blown away by the choices that Ferrari made in this race. First of all, I just think when you have two cars starting where they did, and Fred Vasseur says that they knew before the race that they would need to do something bold to achieve anything, I don't understand why you put them on the same strategy. That doesn't really seem to make much sense to me. If you recognise that you need to risk something to get a big result, would it not make sense to one on the medium, one on the hard, just in case? But that could be a fairly small thing. But it's how they managed it after that. I mean, clearly Leclerc was struggling by the time he pit. But by that time, you know, like I said, Sainz has already done an early pit stop. He doesn't use that tyre advantage because they're focused on covering Hamilton. So that's problematic. And then they make the decision to delay coming in for intermediates, which seems to have been done on the justification of, similar to Aston Martin, thinking that the rain wouldn't be as intense or long in duration as it was. But they were running third and fourth as a result of, staying out when others pit, but that very quickly became undone because Sainz spun at Mirabeau. They swapped positions as a result, but then when they pit and rejoin, they were sixth and eighth. So Leclerc did end up in the same place because he'd obviously lost out to Russell, I think it was, but got one place back because of Sainz. But Sainz lost, I think, three positions versus where he was running originally. So it didn't work out. There's a bit of slightly strange glass half full at best logic from Vasseur claiming that it was a gamble and he's fine with the risk that they took because it didn't cost them anything. But every way I reflect on that race and that situation suggests to me that they did lose something as a result of it. So I'm not entirely sure I agree with that.
I think it just adds to the picture. It's similar to last year. Okay, the Ferrari's not a championship challenging car at this stage of the season as it was last year, but they're still leaving points on the table. You still get to the end of the weekend, it's like, no, you had a car that could have done better than that, and they just got a chunk fewer points than they need. So the execution still isn't there, and I think Sainz's little outburst over the radio shows there's still some real underlying issues there with the way things work. Especially remember Leclerc got that penalty for impeding, which was pretty flat-footed from Ferrari impeding Norris in qualifying. So yeah, there's still just something that's not gelling.
Yeah, it's true. And I was just about to bring up that incident with Leclerc, with the engineers recounting the deficits where he needs to find time when he should have been telling him about where the traffic was. And by the time he was informed, it was too late. So yeah, it's all part of the same old communication problem that's been at Ferrari for a while. and the questionable strategy comes under the same umbrella, doesn't it? It's not. I can't really see that it's changed since last year. I think the only thing that's changed since last year is they have a less competitive car. I think the operations side of it looks very, very much like it did.
Yeah, definitely would agree with that. It was a strange weekend across the board, and obviously Sainz had that little touch of the wall, well, little crash in FP2, wasn't it? He said that didn't affect his confidence, but I don't know, he looked pretty confident up to that point, and I don't know, maybe there was just a little bit missing, but it's just things are just not coming easily to Ferrari. I think that's the way to put it. But let's move on now to Mercedes, because we saw the much vaunted Mercedes upgrades. Mark, fourth place for Lewis Hamilton, fifth for George Russell was the result. Doesn't mean a huge amount in the grand scheme of things, but what are your early impressions of this new direction?
Slightly positive. It seems to be a little bit, the drivers are both saying it feels a little bit better. It feels more stable in the braking. Lewis's front feels a bit nice. He says it's actually quite a nice car to drive around here. So that's positive. That's the first time I've heard Lewis say something like that this year. It probably doesn't mean that much given that this is a very untypical circuit. But it hasn't introduced any new nasties to the car, and I think that's important. And so hopefully it's given them a good platform that they can develop, and we'll see where it's really at. Come Barcelona, you know, where they can start, you know, we can get a more accurate picture of where they're starting from with this upgrade. It looks quite different in the side pods and the front suspension. And it's just, yeah, it looks a more conventional car now. And I think there's reason to be optimistic that they will make progress with it, but you're still talking about a car that's a significantly long way off the pace compared to, you know, to the team's aspirations. So I don't think it's going to transform this season. I think it's going to inform them for next season.
And this was always a starting point, wasn't it? A change of direction. This is something that they hope certainly next year will yield a bigger step, raising the performance potential once you move along that development path. I think the really positive thing is that, as well as the sort of gently optimistic response from the drivers, is the fact that this was a substantial change. Sometimes there's talk about bigger upgrades and they're pretty minor, or certainly visually they're pretty minor. Sometimes you can have things that are significant, but you can't see so much. But the side pod shape, the front suspension, you can clearly see the greater anti-dive. The floor obviously has changed. We got a great look at the floor when Lewis Hamilton had his little crash in FP3, which was great. We saw the Red Bull floor as well when Perez crashed. So I think that's quite positive for Mercedes, that at least it's not a kind of halfway house in terms of the direction they're going. I guess the thing we have to stress, Scott, is it is a halfway house in terms of what they want to do, because they're constrained by some of the architecture of the car that can't be changed this year.
Yeah, so it's a compromised version, I think, of what they would like this first go at this concept to be. Ultimately, this is paraphrasing Andrew Shovlin, but if they were able to start this project with a blank sheet of paper, the car would look different and it would have different features on it. But they're working with what they've got. It's a first step towards it. There will be bigger changes to come. Probably some more changes this year, I'm sure. I suspect they haven't spent their entire budget cap or R&D budget within the budget cap on this upgrade alone. But I think it will be the winter that we see bigger changes. In a way, it's really reminiscent of what Aston Martin did last year, in that you see like a big visual early change that hopefully signals the start of a new direction that goes well. Then a few more updates through the year to start to refine that and get a little bit more out of it, tease some more performance. But the steps are going to be a little bit more gradual until you can get to the winter and make wholesale changes. But I think that Aston Martin comparison does contain a warning for Mercedes in a way, because yes, Aston Martin made good progress over the course of last year, over several months. And yes, they've made another big step over the winter, but they are still trailing Red Bull and still not in a position to beat Red Bull in a straight fight. And I know that Mercedes aren't coming from as low a base as Aston Martin, but that is the timeline that you're looking at to really get on top of a new concept, then introduce bigger changes and then start to optimize it. So there is very much a long way to go.
Yeah, because all the time Red Bull are developing, they're not troubleshooting, they're just working through things. They're not under any particular pressure in the championship. So they can really strategize how they're going to use their limited ATR, etc. So it just makes it much easier for Red Bull. But I think positive signs from Mercedes, and of course with Aston Martin, they took that step last year. And then, although this year's car looks very different in many ways, it is still a big step down that same sort of development path. So I guess the one question you'd ask is whether Mercedes were a bit late making that change, given Aston Martin had a similar problem last year and changed it earlier. But it's very easy to say that from the outside. We'll obviously get a much better picture of the Mercedes when they get to Spain, which is as good a test track probably as Monaco is a bad one. So won't have to wait too long to get a bit of an idea from that. Scott, we should quickly talk about McLaren. They came away with 9th and 10th place with Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri. Solid midfield haul, or signs there's still a lot of work to do?
I think this track was always probably going to suit them a little bit better than somewhere like Miami, which was obviously the very worst of times. It was the darkest timeline for McLaren in many ways. The performance here was a lot stronger from the start. It felt like there was maybe a little bit more to come up until Q3, but I think after the start of the season that they've had, and as I say, how bad Miami was, I think it was good just to kind of almost reset and get back to that baseline level, which is that it's a marginal top 10 car. And then both drivers did a good job in the race. I was really impressed with Oscar Piastri's progression over the course of the week. He seemed to start on a bit of a poor base compared to Norris, obviously nowhere near his experience around Monaco, especially in an F1 car. And then they both handled the conditions very, very well to bank that lower double points finish. And Norris's pace in particular in that final stint on the Inters was really good. So I think there are flashes of potential and signs of positivity. But overall, you know, what Alpine and especially Aston Martin are doing continues to rub McLaren's nose in it a little bit. The fact that we're talking such lowly positions as a positive result just puts the whole season into context, doesn't it?
Yeah, and they're looking at Alpine on the podium and thinking, that's quite a big step forward. Lando Norris after the race wasn't especially delighted. He was okay with where they finished, what they've got, but he was really focusing on the car pace. That's just where it is, which is pretty difficult for them. And of course, they could have ended up with just one car in the points had Tsunoda had avoided that problem he had later because he was struggling with the brakes and then had the brief off. So yeah, hard work for McLaren, but at least rewarded with tick over of points. But it just shows how long away they have to go. But yeah, I also agree Piastri had a good weekend. He's having a sort of low profile but tidy rookie season at this stage, doing a good job.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Well, as always, we'll finish with a batch of questions from the Race Members Club. Head to therace.com and click on Join the Race to find out more about the benefits that extend beyond just being able to throw questions at us for this podcast. Mark, you're first up with this question from Anthony Velasquez. He says, do you read more into Hamilton's positivity about the upgrades than what's at face value?
No, and I don't think Lewis really means any more than he says on it. It's quite, you know... He's not going for gold on it. He's not saying, yes, this is definitely it. He's just saying, it felt quite nice around here. It's the best it's felt to me all season. So, yeah, it's a good first impression. But he's not saying, this is it, we're on our way. So I think what he's saying at face value is pretty much what he means.
Yeah, he's certainly happy with the front end, he said, after qualifying. I suspect that they're being a little bit cautious because this circuit could completely mislead them, so Spain's going to tell them a lot more. Scott, next question for you from Christopher Parrott, who says, is Laurent Rossi's public criticism of the team proving a masterstroke, or is the upturn in performance coincidental?
Oh, it's purely coincidental, and I actually said this earlier in the weekend, that I think there's a that Rossi's probably going to be feeling quite smug about this, especially if Ocon does get on the podium, because they've obviously had they got both cars in the points, didn't they, in Miami, which was obviously 24 hours after he put them on blast, and then they've come here and scored a podium. So it does look a little bit like, you know, correlation equaling causation, but that's just not the case. It was clear to everybody that Alpine was underperforming and had had many better results in the car than they were showing. It was just a case of tidying it up and getting a public sledging from your CEO isn't suddenly going to turn that car into a top three car. I feel like Alpine were already on top of areas that they needed to tidy up operationally. It's just a case of, you know, putting that into practice. I think we would have seen exactly the same step and result in Miami and here if Rossi had just kept, you know, his opinions behind closed doors and read them the riot act in private, or not said anything at all. I find it very hard to believe that there's actually any combination there at all. There certainly would have been maybe a slight increased desire or motivation to prove him wrong and show that you know, everybody in that team is worthy of their position or whatever, but... I don't really think so. I suspect that it would have just played out exactly as it did.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. We should also note that Omar Safnauer, the team principal, said on Friday there's a few little organisational changes going on in the team. It seems it's not so much personnel side as just having a little bit of review of the structure and the who's responsible for what and making sure there's not areas of overlap and not areas where there's a gap. It's just sort of shuffling stuff around. So that they feel like they're already doing things. Omar said that was already in place before the Rossi stuff. A question I'll take now from Christopher Parrott again, who says, how much will the other teams seek to learn from photos of Perez's lofted car's underfloor? Well, they'll seek to learn everything. They will actually learn something. It's slightly tricky because it's very three-dimensional. That's very clear. It will certainly help, and every team will already have the photos of that, certainly in the aerodynamics department. So, yeah, it's certainly not going to do them any harm to have a look at it. It was interesting, actually, Andrew Shovlin at Mercedes said probably the two cars that got lifted, it was much worse for Red Bull from their perspective, so that everyone see their underfloor, than it was for Mercedes. But, yeah, an amusing little incident. The two cars that we most wanted to see the underside of probably this weekend were the two ones we got, including some brilliant pictures directly underneath Hamilton's car as it was craned on Saturday. Mark, another question on a similar topic from Stefan Smith, who says, when Sergio and Lewis's cars were hoisted up, the cars remained very horizontal. In the old days, I remember Marshall sitting on the nose of the car. Has the weight distribution changed a lot over the years?
It has, and on those days that you're referring to, they were very rearward heavy, which is, you know, you'd imagine that to be the case. That's where the engine and gearbox is. But as they developed the cars to be lighter and lighter so they could move that weight distribution forward, they had as much as 50% on the front axle. And they were, you know, there was a period where you saw them being lifted up. They would be, you know, almost perfectly balanced. Now they are, the weight distribution is regulated to within, I think it's 3 kilos either way, isn't it? Something like that. So you don't have much variation, and it's slightly rearward. So, yeah, that's just how it is.
don't really like the weight distribution being mandated. They bought it when the Pirelli tyres were coming in, so no one lucked into something, and then they just said, oh, we'll stick with this. It's 2011, but anyway, I've digressed there well beyond the range of the question. And Scott, another question on a related topic from Urban Strenchan, who says, we saw some controversy regarding the lifting of Sergio Perez's Red Bull and Lewis Hamilton's Mercedes by the crane as the bottom of the cars was seen. Do you think there should be some rule to prevent that from happening in the future?
No, I don't think so. I like those moments because, first of all, things like Toto Wolff's reaction on Saturday, I think it's just quite funny because they just show the inherent paranoia of, you know, this part, the one part of the car that they can basically conceal and trust to not be able to be seen by rivals, unless you're quite careless with, you know, carrying a new floor through the paddock or in the garage if you need to change one mid-weekend or whatever. Suddenly it's on full display. I think you used the phrase in a video script I looked at from you, Ed, where you described it in all its glorious detail, which is just a very nice way of putting it. I think Mercedes probably a little bit more annoyed that more images of the Red Bull don't seem to be quite so freely available. It seemed like every photographer got a great view of the Merc, but not necessarily the Red Bull.
Yeah, I'm not sure how wide those photos were because there's spy photographers around. I know of one team that 100% got the Red Bull because there was a snapper in the right sort of place. So a very interesting one. It's just a happenstance, but it's funny because Hamilton hit the wall and I think he wanted to recover back to the pits himself, but the nose was wedged in the barrier, and then he was desperately trying to get them to avoid it. Husband, whatever you do, don't do this. So and it also just adds a little bit of an extra negative to Sergio Perez. The next question comes from Thomas Knight, which I'll take. Says, in a race where track position is so critical, how poor was the lack of communication from Ferrari about Norris coming up behind Leclerc? In the race, that just ends up costing a lot of time stuck behind Ocon and Hamilton in the first stint. Yeah, we touched on this earlier, and I do think that in particular was extremely poor, because if you watch the Norris onboard, obviously you go into the tunnel, it's the fastest part of the circuit, it's curved, so you haven't got a great line of sight, it's dark, so there's a transition as you go in, and you can see how Norris reacted. It's like, oh, I mean, he was pretty derisive, Norris, about Ferrari, just in terms of like, just don't, it's not hard not to do that. So it's just we talked about communication earlier, and I wonder, it's not clearly about the race engineers. They're not idiots. They know what they need to do. They can do it. But if I was running that team, I'd be saying, right, what's the communication problem here that's making this happen? You need to be focused 100% on that. Is the race engineer having to communicate with a data analysis performance engineer or something too much? So there's got to be some little streamlining going on there. But yeah, hugely costly, hugely dangerous as well. That's what it was particularly problematic for. So yeah, just something Ferrari desperately, desperately needs to improve. And Mark, another question from Thomas Knights for you. Was there any particular reason for Ferrari's shocking pace on the intermediates? Really poor compared to the cars ahead and the McLarens on a track where they thought they would go well. Ended up being a woeful weekend.
They were running pretty low, which was why their behaviour was bad over the bumps. And that's something that you really don't want in wet conditions. It's not good on the braking. When it's in that position, and basically they were being greedy with the ride height, because that's the lower you can run it, if you can run it comfortably there, the more downforce you're going to create. And basically, this car just hasn't got as much downforce relative to the competition, anyways, last year's car. And so they were having to be a little bit more marginal with the way they were running it. And it wasn't in a happy place all weekend, but it was particularly not good in the wet, because then, you know, the problem just spirals. It affects your tire temperatures, and then the tire temperatures affects the performance, which you just get in this horrible spiral. And yeah, interesting that you talked about the McLarens, because they were absolutely flying in the wet. And both Piastri and Norris were fastest guys on the track for a brief period.
Next one for you, Scott, from Danny Janowski, who says, will Lance Stroll, even Lawrence Stroll is going to have his seat at the top of Aston Martin, whatever happens. Will Lance Stroll still have a seat if his poor performance compared to Alonso costs Aston Martin P2 in the championship? Lance qualified 1.2 seconds slower than Alonso this weekend. A well-read question there for me. It was much more coherent the way Danny put it.
it's a difficult one for Stroll, and off the back of a Miami weekend in which he underperformed as well. It's really not good. I think he does need to turn a corner very, very quickly. He had a very good start to the season, especially in the context of that injury that he was carrying and made him miss preseason testing. But that was at a time when Aston Martin was a lot more... and I'm not saying that Aston Martin has slipped in its position here. They were a lot more clear-cut, the second best team, because Mercedes and Ferrari were a lot more messy. I think Merckx kind of tidied that up a little bit, but Ferrari maybe not so much. But the midfield teams were further away. We talked about Alpine obviously making that step, becoming a bit more consistent as they brought upgrades to the car. And you know, McLaren and AlphaTauri, for example, were nowhere at the first race or two, and they've made gains as well. So I think even when you're in a car like the Aston, and Mercedes have seen it as well, if you do have an off weekend and you underperform by 2-3 tenths of a second or more, in this case with Stroll quite a bit more, you are going to find yourself a lot further down the grid. And I think, and I'm not saying that he was underachieving early in the year and got away with it, but you would get away with it with the gaps that we saw sort of at the start of the season, is kind of my point. And it's been a bit disappointing to see that Stroll hasn't gone with Alonso. The car has been getting these little improvements. Alonso's still scoring podiums. This was the best result yet for him and the team. And on that weekend, on that race, Stroll posts another stinker of a weekend. Whether there was something wrong with the car or engine or whatever to really explain it, hard to say. But this was really, really disappointing. And that key part of the question, you know, is his seat going to be in doubt? I'd be surprised short to medium term if it was, because I just think there will always be a case of making excuses for him and justifying keeping him around, especially if he does have more races like he did in the first four weekends than the last two. But long term, when you've got a partner like Honda coming on board and more money's been sunk into the project and the factory and new wind tunnel and simulator are all up and running, and there aren't any excuses from a team point of view, and you become more and more driver limited, as they're finding themselves now in the Constructors' Championship, the nepotism-based argument of keeping your son in the team, it gets less and less easy for everybody else to stomach. So he needs to pull his finger out. Otherwise, there will be a serious conversation. It will have to be had within the team.
Yeah, it becomes much, much easier to see the effect when you're running up to or to the front. And in fairness, he was on a lap that would have got him through to Q3 in Q2 when he went deep at Raskas. And he did have a bit of damage on the underfloor from hitting some Norris debris. And that was a real reason, because they were allowed to change the underfloor overnight, and you have to prove there's external damage there to be able to do it. But even so, he wasn't at Alonso's level. Anyway, the next question I will take comes from Philippe Esposito. He says, how worrisome was Tsunoda's dissatisfaction with his brakes, especially given AlphaTauri's considerable problems last season? Well, it's obviously problematic for Tsunoda, who was struggling with brakes throughout the race, and it was particularly tricky once it was wet. Obviously, he lost that points finish. He'd had a really, really good weekend, especially seeing as they had a slightly difficult Friday and then those other problems. I don't think it's a hugely worrying problem in the grander scheme of things. They do have a few occasions at AlphaTauri where they struggle a bit with the brake. Gasly had it a few times last year. So they maybe need to look at some of their warm-up processes and the way you prep the brakes. I don't know whether they're struggling with a bit of glazing here and there or what. I'm not sure. But yeah, I think the positive for AlphaTauri is that their mechanical package is good and they're decent on tracks like this. Tsunoda's driving well. But yeah, it all just fell apart relatively late on this time. Mark, you have mentioned this already, but JK asks, just how impressive was the pace of both Norris and Piastri on the inters phase towards the end of the race? Was it just a case of the cars ahead not pushing very hard?
No, it's an element of that for sure, but I think it was also that the car was just very good in whether it's the car or the drivers or the combination of them being at ease with the traits of the car in those conditions. But they had no reason to be pushing hard. They weren't going to catch who was next in front of Sainz. That was just the natural pace they were running at, and I think it was they could have run at the front of the field at that pace. So it doesn't really tell you anything. It can be that a car's just happy in the wet. That it is not particularly quick in the dry. But I think they're both very, very quick weather drivers. We had a wet weather session in Melbourne earlier in the year, and Piastri was extremely quick in that. And we've seen great performances in the wet from Norris, of course, in the past as well.
Yeah, it does just reflect some good driving performances as well. Scott, the final question goes to you from Oscar Robledo, who says, was one of the consequences of the increased minimum weight limit to beef up the suspensions? The number of kisses and brushes of the wall during qualifying in the race would have resulted in retirement in years gone by.
I don't think it's necessarily... I don't think it's necessarily related to that. I remember asking Alpine technical director Matt Harmon last year if they'd consciously made their car so robust, because I remember last year the Alpine surviving quite a few big hits with certain things, the most notable example being Alonso's big shunt at Austin, where he went airborne, landed heavily and was able to continue. And Harmon's suggestion was that it was more when you had have a new set of rules, you maybe build a little bit of extra tolerance or robustness into the car just in case, and then you try and lean it off as you find other ways to get down to the weight limit without compromising the integrity. So my suspicion is just that all these kisses and brushes of the wall this weekend were just the type where they're at the right angle, or they're not necessarily hard enough in at the right angle to cause a big problem. I suspect a few cars were running with front or rear wheels with a little bit more toe in or toe out than they were meant to be when they left the garage. But I think we actually see quite often that the cars can put up with a little bit of. They've got a bit of give and take in them. Let's put it that way. And while nudging the barriers at Monaco is quite an aggressive way to exemplify that, I think it just shows that these cars are fairly robust. They can put up with a fair bit.
Yeah, exactly. And if anything, the new rules, certainly last year, will have almost mitigated against strength, because they were trying to battle so hard to get down to the weight limit. You might have taken more risks and built in less margin. So yeah, I'd agree with you that it's just one of those things, just a fluke of the way that you happen to glance the walls. There's, of course, an art in that on street circuits. As any driver who gets away with it will probably try and tell you. Well, thanks very much, Scott and Mark, for your insight. Head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen, plenty to read there, both from the Monaco Grand Prix and as we build up to the Spanish Grand Prix. Check out our other podcasts, including our tech show, the Race F1 Tech Show with Gary Anderson. We'll be talking a lot about the Mercedes upgrade in that. So look out for that later this week. And also have a look at our YouTube channel. Lots of videos to watch there. Well, there's not much time to wait because the Spanish Grand Prix is coming up, so stay with us for everything you need to know from the world of Formula One.
The Athletic.